Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we will be talking about the continuing conflict in Darfur, something that has been considered now for some time by many people around the world as one of the worst humanitarian disasters in the world. In fighting that has been going on there since 2003, it's estimated that at least 200,000 people have died and more than 2.5 million people have been driven from their homes. Our guest this morning is Brian Steidel. When he arrived in Darfur in September of 2004, this conflict there had already been labeled a genocide. He was one of three Americans that were hired by the African Union as observers. And when he was there, he witnessed countless villages destroyed and saw many people murdered. Finally, frustrated by the unwillingness of the international community to get involved, he resigned and since that time has been speaking out. He is the co-author, along with his sister, of a book based on some of what he saw. The title of the book is The Devil Came on Horseback, Bearing Witness to the Genocide in Darfur, and it's published by Public Affairs, and certainly I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore. He also has been involved in making a documentary film with the same title about the same subject that has been shown. It had its premiere at the Sundance Festival. He's planning on taking it to some other festivals. There will be a selected release in some theaters, and it's my understanding that also it will be available in the fall on DVD for anybody who would like to see it. He's talking with us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome from people who are listening. The only thing that we ask people who are listening is that people just try to be brief in their comments, just so that we can our program moving along and, again, as many different people as possible. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So locally here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, comments, you're certainly welcome to call. Brian Steidel, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
And I understand it just you're at a film festival now, is that right?
Yes, that's true.
In Las Vegas?
Yes, at the Cine Vegas Film Festival.
Okay, great. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. Just to get us started, it seems to me that one of the things that makes this difficult to understand for a lot of people, perhaps, is that this is not just one conflict. There's really two things going on, and you can correct me if I don't have this right. It seems that on the one hand, what we have here is a political conflict involving people who live in the Darfur region who felt that their interests, their needs were not being taken into account by the government back in Khartoum and felt that an armed insurrection was the only way they could get the attention of the government. But at the same time, there was a much older conflict that it has an ethnic dimension where you have people, two groups of people who identified themselves as distinct groups, where one is making war on the other with the help of the government. And it seems that is the greatest problem and has been the greatest problem for some time now. But the two things are all tangled up together. Do I have a fair handle on it, do you think?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the government tried to stand down this rebel, these rebel movements inside of the country and to make an example out of them for the rest of the country. I mean, there are rumblings of different rebel groups and possible other conflicts all around the country, in the north, in the east areas, and still within the south, even though a peace treaty has been signed. So the government wanted to make an example out of these rebel groups, and that's why they've tried to not only just take out the rebel groups, but basically take about everybody that is associated with them, all of the tribes that support them, all of the villages that support them.
Mm-hmm. This ethnic conflict, we have two groups of people. We have one, people that identify themselves and that are seen by everyone as African, quote-unquote, as African. And then we have a group that see themselves as, quote-unquote, Arab. And these are the people that are called the Janjaweed. And just to explain the title of your book, that's what Janjaweed means, right? Devil on horseback?
Yes. Yeah, the Janjaweed mean the devil on a horse. And not to say that all of the Arab communities within Darfur, within Sudan, are these Janjaweed.
Are Janjaweed. Okay.
That's most definitely wouldn't be accurate to say that. There are some Arab communities that have also suffered from this conflict and are displaced from their areas and are not able to receive aid like a lot of the African areas.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very distinct group. These Janjaweed members, it would be the equivalency of our government training and arming the Ku Klux Klan during the Civil Rights Movement to go stand the Civil Rights Movement. Now, they are a very distinct group of Arab individuals associate themselves as being Arab. They're extremely racist, that want this land for themselves, and that don't care about these African populations. And the government of Sudan has used them in the past, and they continue to use them to do these horrific things.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to be clear here also, the government of Sudan has officially denied supporting the Janjaweed. They said that they have not done this. I think that generally the rest of the world feels that that's not the case, that in fact the government has backed the Janjaweed. Do you feel that it is in fact the case that the government has supported the Janjaweed?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's plain and simple. I mean, and anybody who's educated on the conflict, anybody who's been there on the ground, knows it for sure. I mean, the Janjaweed now are... More of them are in uniform. Some of them have been incorporated into the regular armed forces. If you ask them where they get their weapons and where they get their training, they'll tell you the government did. Government gave them the training. Government gave them the weapons. They even tell you where they got trained by the government. So it's no secret that the government of Sudan is supporting these Arab militias who kill the people.
And you would say that it was clear that it was a matter of the policy of the government to use the Janjaweed as a kind of a proxy army to tamp down any kind of rebel activity in this region?
Absolutely.
I'm interested in having you tell just a little bit of your story about how it is you came to be there. You spent time in the Marines, 4 years in the Marines, I believe?
Yeah, a little more, four and a half years.
Four and a half years. And then it was after that that you were involved in the monitoring the ceasefire in the Sudan war that had gone on for a very long time. This was basically a north-south war. It did have a religious dimension. It was Christian versus Muslim. And in this particular case in Darfur, everybody's Muslim, so that's not an issue. But you were involved in the monitoring the settlement of that war. Why did you decide, what made you decide after having been in the Marines that you wanted to do that?
Well, I basically had gotten out of the Marine Corps after my obligation. I was looking for some adventure. I was looking to get back out on the ground somewhere, go someplace new. I found a job on the internet. It said Patrol Leader Sudan. I paid well. I said, great, let's go, and headed off to Sudan. And that's when I found myself in the Nuba Mountains, monitoring the North-South ceasefire. Just like you said, it not only did it have a racial an ethnic element to this war of these Arab groups and the government oppressing and attacking these African areas, but they use religion as an excuse to pull in other groups from around the country and basically said, well, we're gonna call this a jihad on the South because they're Christian. So I monitored that ceasefire within the Nuba Mountains for 7 months, worked my way up to be a senior operations officer for the mission, and I essentially found myself behind a desk again in the middle of Africa and wanted to get back out on the field. I wanted to, to get out to interact with the people, to learn about their culture. And so I heard about a mission opening up in Darfur and volunteered for it.
Yeah, so it's...
sent to that mission there.
And it sounds like one of the things that happened was that somebody, someone that you knew or that had been there came back, and you, as I read the story, it was you just said to him, well, something like, well, what's going on there? And he said, well, you wouldn't believe it, and then showed you some photographs of stuff that he had seen there. And it was that point that part of what happened was you just thought, I have to go see this for myself.
Yeah, it was this gentleman brought back some photographs from a confidential AU report, which showed this village that had been attacked, a village of Sulaya, where it was a girls' school that they targeted It was the Arab militia targeted. They had chained these young girls together, had raped them and then burnt them alive. And then they also poured petrol on a number of the individuals in the village and burned them alive as a kind of an example to everybody to not try to stop them. And so I was just like, this is unbelievable. We heard rumblings of, you know, something's happening in Darfur, but we didn't really know what. And I saw that and I said, wow, this is unbelievable. I said, I've got to see this for myself. I can't just be sitting here 250 miles away and not know what's going on. I have to find out.
And this was in 2004?
This was in, August 2004. I headed over there and arrived shortly thereafter.
When you were in Sudan, who were you working for? Who was paying your salary?
I actually can't tell that. I was working for a private contracting company. The State Department pays a number of contracting companies to hire people to do, you know, election monitoring and you know, logistics things for missions like this and monitoring missions and things like that.
So,
but due to the nature of my contract, I'm not allowed to say exactly who deployed me.
I see. Well, and then who was it? Your role as an observer, was it part of your job to do some kind of reporting on what you had seen and then send that back somewhere else?
Yes, our job was to monitor, to write reports about what we'd seen. We used photography and implanted that into these Word documents. And then we would send them up to the African Union chain of command. They were supposed to go up and end up in Addis Ababa, where they were supposed to be disseminated among embassies and people that were interested. And after working for a while, I had found out through an embassy contact that our embassy had only received four reports, and they were wondering, you know, if all this violence is going on, why weren't we writing more reports? And we were surprised because we had written close to 80, and we didn't know what was happening to them. They were falling off the airplane somewhere, so we decided to supply it directly to our embassy.
So presumably the idea was supposed to be that you were sending your reports to the AU and they were supposed to be forwarding them on to the U.S. government?
Yes, that's true. The U.S. and other governments.
Yeah, and they apparently weren't. They were just being bottled up somehow there at the head office of the AU.
Yep, somewhere along the chain they were basically disappearing.
So you apparently at some point felt that what you had seen was so horrifying that the rest of the world, the U.S. government, the rest of the world, the people of the United States really ought to know, that you decided yourself, you took it upon yourself to go public about this because you weren't supposed to do that, right?
No, it was kind of unsaid that I shouldn't say anything. And, I was frustrated with the mission mainly. That's why I ended up leaving. I was frustrated with our inability to stop what was going on. I was frustrated with the lack of resources that the AU had or the mandate that they had that we weren't able to protect people. So I left the mission, came back to the States. I'd been back in the States for about 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Made an introduction with Nicholas Kristof at the New York Times. And he basically said, hey, look, Brian, you know, if you want to do something good here, I believe that's the reason you're sitting in my office. He says, we've got to use your name and we've got to come out public with this so there can be somebody behind these photos. And I said, okay, go ahead. And that's what started it all.
Well, let me again introduce our guest. We're talking with Brian Steidel. He's the co-author, along with his sister, Gretchen Steidel Wallace, of the book The Devil Came on Horseback, Bearing Witness to the Genocide in Darfur, about some of his experiences. We've just sketched out here very briefly. It's published by Public Affairs Books. He's also involved with a documentary that has the same title, Devil Came on Horseback. It's had some showings at some festivals, will be shown apparently in some theaters. There will be a DVD of this out in the fall. And if you're interested, you can seek it out. Also here on the program, if you're interested in asking questions, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Now, I think that one of the questions that is continually asked about this conflict is, how is it that now it's been allowed to go on for, we're now in the fourth year, and a lot of people have died, and a lot of people have been driven from their homes, and people keep asking, and it's not exactly a secret. It has gotten some attention from international media, and certainly the United States government has voiced concern. The Secretary of State, Colin Powell, went as far as to say that he thought it was genocide. The United Nations hasn't said that, but he said that. So a number of governments have voiced concern, but that gets us back to this question that why is it now that all these, it's been going on all these years and it's still going on, even though everyone says this is one of the worst things happening any place in the world?
Yeah, it's actually quite amazing to me. I thought when we came out that we'd be able to get this media storm going like we did before. Hopefully, I was hoping that we'd get the book out sooner. The book was was released in March, so that people could hear about it before the conflict was over. And here we are, still talking about it, and it's actually quite ridiculous, really, that this genocide has been allowed to continue this long. The labeling of genocide, I know it has certain ramifications, or at least it's supposed to. I don't think that's really the important argument here. I mean, basically, nobody's arguing about what's happening on the ground. Nobody's arguing that women are being gang raped, that people are being killed in tremendous numbers, that they're being tortured, that people are being enslaved, their houses are being destroyed. That's what's happening, and the world should stand up and stop it. And I think that, this time the United States has decided to try to let the international community use its powers through the UN to make something happen here, to stop this from happening. And I think it's been shown to the world that the UN has many, many hurdles that it has to jump before it can actually stop something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's becoming very frustrating to our government.
I talked about the fact that that Darfur has gotten media attention, and there have been people who have talked about it, people in government, people like Nick Kristof certainly have written about it a lot, and he's written about it in his column in the New York Times. I wonder, though, if part of the problem is that actually that the news media haven't given it in as much attention perhaps as it deserves, or maybe part of the problem is that it's difficult to go there and report on it on the ground. Not that many people have been able to go and see it like you saw it. So perhaps if we saw more direct coverage, or if people had a chance to see more photographs like those that you have taken, that might make some difference.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you. The thing is we report on places that are easy to report on. If we can get camera crews in there, if we can get people on the ground talking about it, then that's what we're going to report on. Darfur is closed off, and the Sudanese government knows this. When the rebellion started in 2003, first thing the government did was to kick out all foreign journalists, and then they just went on this rampage because they know that people will report on what's going on there. So somebody may get a visa to Sudan, but they sit in Khartoum waiting for the permission to get to go to Darfur. Then when they get there, they don't get a photography permit. They're not allowed to travel around freely, and if they are allowed to travel, they've got some security official attached to them telling them they can't take pictures of that and they can't take pictures of that. So they make it so difficult for these news agencies to get in there. You can't accurately report on it. You have to report on it from just certain reports that come out on the ground, and people want to see what's happening. They want to know what's happening.
Mm. The part of the problem here, the difficulty, I think, for the international community has been that the steadfast refusal all along by the government of Sudan to allow a foreign presence there, to allow peacekeepers. Now, apparently there are a few thousand AU troops, not nearly enough to do the job, and some people say what we really need to do is get a significant number in there to try to provide some kind of protection for the people, that the civilians, people who are non-combatants, they're the ones who are getting killed, they're the ones that are getting driven from their homes, and that what we need is to get some people in there to see if they can try to, I guess, be some kind of a barrier in between the Janjaweed and the African Darfurian, the Darfur people, who are the ones who are in trouble. What do we do about that? I mean, if you have a government that says, look, this is our country, and says to the rest of the world, essentially, this is none of your business, what do you do about that, do you think?
Yeah, I think that they, first of all, I mean, the African Union doesn't have the capability to go into Sudan without Sudan's permission, from the way I understand the African Union is structured. They have to have the permission of the Sudanese government. That's why their mandate is weak. Their mandate is to monitor and not to protect the people. That's why we need a UN force that can have a mandate, or even a NATO force that can have a mandate to protect the people on the ground. In order for the UN to do that, they have to have the Security Council approve them. China has been one of these hurdles at the Security Council. So the way I think it needs to be done is that the Sudanese government isn't going to allow people in. And obviously, I don't see what their motivation would be to allow people in, because they're the ones that are doing the killing. Why would they want somebody to stop them? They've been able to kill these people for 4 years. The estimates, 200,000... extremely low estimate in most people's eyes. It's closer to 450,000 to 500,000. They are successfully wiping out this population. They don't want anybody to come in. So I think it's up to the UN to stand up and say, we are not going to allow these things to happen on the face of the earth, and that's why we exist. And so they need to move in without the permission of the Sudanese government and stop these horrific crimes.
There was a story just yesterday that the United Nations and the AU had come to some sort of tentative agreement about a fairly significant 23,000, I think is the number that I saw, a fairly significant peacekeeping force, something that would be a joint UN-AU mission. And perhaps the hang-up here was going to be who is in command. If it turns out that the AU is in command of the mission, do you think that it would have some hope of being successful, or do we still hear, we're still looking at the same problem with the government of Sudan saying that they won't let them in?
I think that, first of all, it needs to be one organization that heads it, not this dual head that has been talked about with the African Union and the UN heading mission. You can't have two commanders in a military mission, because then you always have to go back and find consensus before something can happen on the ground. Cannot have a successful military operation like this. There has to be one, first of all. And I think that one head needs to be the UN. The UN will bring with it much more power than the African Union has. The African Union wants to do wants to do a tremendous job on the ground. I applaud them for everything they've done thus far. I really believe that it needs to be UN. They can bring more power to the table than the African Union can against another African country.
We're just about on our midpoint here, and just let me very quickly introduce again our guest. We're talking with Brian Steitel. He's a former U.S. Marine who in 2004 was involved in monitoring the ceasefire in the Sudan War when he heard about what was going on in Darfur and decided he needed to go there and see it for himself. And when he got there, this was at a time when already some people said that what was going on there was genocide. He was part of a small team of observers hired by the African Union, and he saw a lot of death and destruction. And finally, when he came home, decided it was not something that he could keep quiet about, that he wanted to talk about it, and has been doing that. He has co-authored a book with his sister. The title of the book is The Devil Came on Horseback, Bearing Witness to the Genocide in Darfur, and it came out earlier this spring. It's published by Public Affairs Books. Also, he was involved in making a documentary with the same title that had its premiere at the Sundance Festival, has been shown at some others. He's now in Las Vegas at a film festival there where they're showing the movie. It will be shown in some theaters and also will be available as a DVD in the fall. So questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call here. We have someone in Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. The fact that you won't name Blackwater or some other group like that as your employer should make everyone very suspicious of your line. I'm not denying the disaster in Darfur, but Blackwater was involved in training the Christian, and this is a fair, I guess, in the South, some of the opponents of the uprising in the South, opponents of the Sudanese government, and the U.S. has been involved in that kind of machinations for quite a few years, so it's it's not the case that, you know, the U.S. is a disinterested outside party at all. As far as China being a problem, Ban Ki-moon and Margaret Beckett both in the last week have said that they feel that the Chinese are actually contributing to some kind of stability in Darfur right now, which is undercutting. It's not quite widely reported, but you can find it on the BBC website if you look for Darfur and Margaret Beckett. What the press needs to be doing as far as reporting is reporting the antecedents of this disaster in Darfur, and not coming off with the kind of self-righteous attitude that is so easy for them to fall into. Obviously, this is completely heretical to your guests and most analysis, but I'd like for a little response, and particularly, what about Blackwater in the South? What about your getting money from such a similar organization? Do not people challenge you on credibility when you say that you can't specify who was paying your salary?
First of all, I didn't work for Blackwater. I don't know what Blackwater did in the South. I'm not familiar with their operations or their organization. I worked for a group that provided logistics and support using military observers for this mission. And they're a great, legit organization. Just due to the contract that I had, I'm not able to say who they are. You know, I mean, if they want to release me from that, I'd be happy to say who they are, because they're a tremendous organization. I love the people I work with. But, we're talking about a genocide here and things that I saw, and it really didn't matter what capacity I was there in. I saw them. I could have been a tourist. I could have been working for the State Department directly. I could have been, you know, some operative on the ground or somebody else. These things are still going on the ground, and that's basically what I'm talking about. It doesn't matter who I was working for, what I was doing. This is what I saw. And I just wanted to make one point about the China. China has been coming out and realizing that they are a world player. Has been trying to put more influence on the Sudanese government to, you know, convince them to allow a UN peacekeeping force on the ground, allow them, to try to have them stop this genocide. It's still not enough. In my mind, China could stop this war tomorrow. They buy close to 80% of Sudan's oil. Around 70 to 80% of that money that goes back directly to the government, doesn't help people out at all, is used for military funding. China just recently gave technology to Sudan to build 3 Kalashnikov factories in their own country, so they don't have to import weapons anymore or buy them or trade oil for them. So China is most definitely contributing to this war. But at the same time, they are coming around and realizing that it's making them look bad in the world's eyes, and said they need to start becoming a world player and start decreasing their human rights violations within their own country and start stopping these things around the world. And so, you know, I applaud them for their recent efforts. I think that they have a long way to go, many steps to take before, you know, we should, you know, hold them as high up in the air and say China is great. They've got a long way to go.
You don't have any comment on the U.S.'s earlier role in the area and the whole...
I don't know what the U.S.'s role was within the South and whether we trained people or not. I'm not knowledgeable on that. I didn't operate in the South. I operated in the Nuba Mountains for 7 months where I never saw any training going on. We were involved in huge demining operations within the Nuba Mountains and monitoring and assisting with aid, but I didn't see any type of training going on by the U.S. government in the Nuba Mountains. So I'm not familiar with the South in over the last 20 years. I'm not a Sudan expert. I talk about what I know and what I saw, and that's what I saw.
Well, I'm sorry you got the impression that it was just in the South. The U.S. role doesn't extend just to the South. I'm just pointed out that Blackwater had the contract nominally directly from the rebels, but there's a lot of covert things, various kinds of aid going on. I just think that people should not make a snap judgment about this. I think we should be working more on our own direct U.S. role in the world, which is devastating Iraq. But that's another show. Thank you.
Well, Brian, is there from what you do know and from what your experience, would you say that there was any way that anything the United States did that actually made things worse other than not doing anything?
No, absolutely not. I mean, the United States provides a tremendous amount of aid. From the numbers I saw when I was there, you know, the United States is providing close to 80% of the food aid that's coming in Darfur. I mean, we're talking billions of dollars the United States has spent on keeping these people alive and trying to do something to stop this conflict. I would love to find out if the caller's still on the line where he gets this information from, because I would love to research it to be more knowledgeable. I mean, anything I can find out to be able to speak more knowledgeable about the situation, I would love to find out about that information. I didn't see any of it. I don't know what Blackwater's role is in this. I know that apparently that they have offered up a contract free of charge to go take care of the John Jaweed. I don't think that's the right method. I don't think that we should use forces in that manner, or companies in that manner to go take care of business around the world. I think they can be used much better, possibly go deliver aid, escorting aid to these million people that are now unreachable by the aid organizations. I think that would be a much more worthwhile use of any type of force on the ground.
All right, let's talk with someone else. I believe that this is a caller in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello. What can be done to put pressure on China? And I'm thinking of two particular areas. One, is there any particular export products that the United States could boycott, or would it be productive to possibly boycott the Olympics?
Yeah, I think that we can definitely put a lot more more pressure on China. And specifically, let me address the boycott of the Olympics first. I personally don't believe that a boycott of the Olympics is the right way and the right approach. First of all, on one standpoint, I don't think China would respond to it. Two, I don't think that it's right for us who are not Olympians to go ahead and call for a boycott Olympics. I mean, the individuals that are going to be going from our country to go play in those Olympics have been training their entire lives every single day to get one chance to go to the Olympics, and this is their one chance. I think that we can use them, first of all, by educating them about China's role in this, so that when they go to the Olympics and they get on the screen and they're talking to a television reporter, they can be like, I am so happy to be able to take part in these Olympic Games. We really wish China would do more about Darfur. Educate them so they know what they're doing. They can write letters to President Hu so that they can, try to influence them to do more. So I think that is the best role. By labeling it the Genocide Olympics, I think that was brilliant idea that Mia Farrow has taken up. But boycott, I don't think would be the right approach. Now, on the second, the other part of the question, there's a website called SudanDivestment.org. Again, SudanDivestment.org. If you go on that, you can punch in your ticker symbol of any of your mutual funds, and it will pull up all the companies that are in your mutual fund and flag any one of them that's involved in this genocide. There's around 500 companies that operate in Sudan, and approximately two dozen or so are complicit in this genocide, companies like Sudatel that turn off their cell phone towers to allow the government to attack without warning. Companies like PetroChina that are the ones buying the oil from Sudan and providing arms and trade or funds that then go directly to fund this war. So there's many companies. Take them out. Just released a new report of all these companies. It's a very, very extensive report that has all these companies labeled in it and what their involvement is in it. And so that's something we can definitely have. Hit them in the pocketbook. That works everywhere. It worked in divestment worked to end apartheid in South Africa. And so each individual can do that. States are starting to divest. We've had 14 states pass legislation to divest pension plans, many cities across the country. So definitely check your area and find out what's the divestment in your state, in your city, in your town, or even within your business. Is your business involved in doing this? Are your retirement funds, sitting in some company that's supporting a genocide? A lot of people don't know it. So don't blame them for it, but just check it out. That's something we can definitely do.
Well, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Again, other questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Brian Steidel. He's a former captain in the Marines who worked for the African Union as an observer, as an observer in the ceasefire in the long-running North-South War, and then also in Darfur. And now he spends his time talking about it. He felt that it was something that the world needed to know about, and has co-authored a book, The Devil Came on Horseback, Bearing Witness to the Genocide in Darfur. It's published by Public Affairs. He's also been involved with a documentary film that had its premiere at Sundance. He's now in Las Vegas, where it's being shown at a festival. It will get some exposure in theaters. It will also be available in the fall on DVD. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I really haven't given you the opportunity very much to talk about what it is that you saw in Darfur. Just tell a story of something that you saw that would put across to people what has been going on there.
Wow, I mean, there's so many. For us, it was every day. We were, you know, primarily in South Darfur, in Nyala, and our job was to do this monitoring. So we received these reports, sometimes many a day, and we would go out to these villages. I mean, for example, a village of Labado, where it was being attacked by the government of Sudan, around 3,500 troops and 1,500 these Arab militias, these Janjaweeds, were, you know, attacking using helicopter gunships and Antonov to bomb. And we were flying above, watching a lot of this happening. We were landing on the ground, you know, talking to the commander, trying to convince him to pull his troops out of the town and stop the attack. And basically, we just had to stand there on the edge of the village and watch his troops, you know, burn and loot this village. And we weren't able to even walk into the village. We just stood on the side of it and watched all this happen. And, you know, that for us was nearly an everyday occurrence.
Hmm. And then that was that your job simply was to observe this, and then, as we talked earlier, that just and then report back, file reports on this that went to the AU?
Yes, that was it. Just watch, take pictures if we could. You know, when we're on the ground, the general's like, no, you're not taking pictures. He wasn't actually allowed to deny us that, but, you know, he's got 3,500 troops and 1,500 Janjaweed, and I have, you know, pocket knife. So he wins. I don't take pictures. So that became difficult. You know, they tried to restrict. They try to restrict the African Union everywhere they can. You know, denying the fuel to fill up the helicopters. You know, when we're trying to get out on, by claiming that their fuel pumps are broken or that they didn't get their fuel delivered. By, you know, harassing us at every turn. I don't know, who are you? And having some young, you know, young guy out there in the field who's saying, I don't know who you are. You're not allowed through here. And it's like, what are you talking about? You know, we're the African Union. We're all over the place. Oh, I don't know who you are. You can't come through. And it just delays us 45 minutes in working our way up the chain of command, so that we can get through, so that you know, they can try to clean up the mess that they're causing.
Hmm. You were not armed?
We were unarmed. We did have a protection force, and that's what the majority of the individuals right now in the African Union mission on the ground is a protection force, and their job is to protect the monitors, such as myself, and to protect the monitoring team's assets, such as helicopters and the camps and things like that. So that's mainly what they secure. Although when we went on these helicopters, we are an 8-man team, and these helicopters carry 13 people or so. So we would take, you know, two guys with us sometimes that would just stand and protect our helicopter while we were out, you know, monitoring within the village. That's all the armed people we'd normally take with us. Sometimes if we rolled on the ground for a vehicle, we'd take a few more, but that was all we would do.
Let's take another call here. We have someone on the cell phone. This is coming in on our toll-free line, our line 4. Hello.
Hi, yes, this is Jacob Klein.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm just wondering, one of the things that I find the most disturbing about this is just the lack of media coverage here in the States. And I'm wondering if you could offer some further suggestions about what ordinary people can do to get this issue out there, and especially to try to help rally the media coverage on this. I, for example, am a graduate student right now at Cornell, and I would love to just get involved in any way I can, even writing articles, if I can do that in some venue. I just wonder if you could say something about that.
Sure. You know, each one of us who watches the news, listens to the radio, you know, picks up a newspaper, we're all consumers of that product. And we have a right and I think it's not only a right, but it's a necessity to tell our news media what we want to hear. So by calling the editors, by writing them, by shooting them out emails, saying, you know, I mean, first of all, don't blast them, you know, your coverage on Darfur sucks, because they're never going to listen to you. But if you come at them with a positive attitude, hey, look, I've been a lawyer listener for, you know, 20 years. We'd really like it if you could cover more about Darfur. There are stories out from the AP and Reuters and BBC, you know, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, they all post reports. There is stuff that can be reported on. There are stories out there. You know, I mean, I have photographs to lend to those if anybody's out there's listening, you know, so that people can see what's going on. I do think it's really important, and we just need to call our media and say, look, you know, we don't care where Michael Jackson is. Yep. We don't care, you know, one more story about Anna Nicole Smith. We want to know about what's the real stuff that's going on in this world. We want to know what the United States and what the world's doing about the genocide of the 21st century. And if you ask them to do that, they'll cover it for you.
Yep. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the stand that you're taking.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Again, others are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. When you were in the Marines, you were in Kosovo. Is that right?
Yes, I did. We did a short 30-day tour in Kosovo on the southern border of Macedonia. Well, on the southern border of Kosovo with Macedonia.
Were you had before that? Had you spent time elsewhere in the former Yugoslavia, or was that your first experience there?
That was my first experience there, and it was actually a very positive experience.
I'm just having seen that you had at least some experience there. I guess I was just wondering if you saw any kinds of parallels or any kinds of way in which what's going on in Sudan is like what had happened in the former Yugoslavia.
You know, we were there much later on. Yeah. We weren't there when, you know, the large conflicts were raging on. We were there mainly to stop, you know, arms trafficking from coming over the border to try to, you know, stand down any possible, you know, uprising again. I don't see, I mean, besides it being a genocide, it's very different. I mean, it's the government that has orchestrated this genocide, the government that is pitting different tribes against different tribes. I mean, these tribes have coexisted for hundreds and hundreds of years. They've lived side by side. They've traded each other. And the government basically has pitted them against each other and formed this ethnic cleansing within their own country. And it's quite unique. I mean, it's what they did in the South. They used the Darfurians in their army to go kill the Southerners because they were Muslim, even though they were black. To the government, you know, when I say black, I mean African, black Africans. To them, it didn't really matter who died on either side because to the government, it was Africans that were dying. And so it was great. You know, right now in Darfur, they're using a large number of individuals from the eastern Blue Nile region on the far eastern side of their country to come in and to kill these Darfurians because they're of a different tribe. They're forming these ethnic conflicts within their own country.
Hmm. You know, as we've said, it has the conflict definitely has an ethnic dimension with the Janjaweed described as Arabs, mm-hmm. and the Darfur people as Africans. I hope this doesn't seem to be a stupid or naive question, but do they look any different? Could you, as an outside observer, could you tell the difference between a black, an African, a Darfurian, and an Arab?
I could tell the difference probably 50% of the time. If you look at them or you see our movie, I got a question last night at Q&A. He's like, well, wait a minute, I don't understand. They all look black to me. I mean, we're not talking, you know, Arab as in Saudi Arabian Arab. It's a different identity. And I told the gentleman in the audience last night, I said, you and I are both white, right? And we both look the same. I said, but our ethnic backgrounds are different. You know, I'm German, Irish, Scottish, Chippewa, and you are, you know, whatever you are. I said, we are different ethnic backgrounds, even though we're white. So this is an identity. Generally speaking, the Arab tribes are lighter skinned and are mainly nomadic. Generally speaking, the African tribes are darker skinned and are mainly farmers. But that's not clear cut across it. There has been intermarriages within these tribes for many, many generations. And so you can identify yourself as one or the other. For myself, I can identify myself as Irish, you know, as I do on St. Patrick's Day, and I can identify myself as being a German, as I do during Oktoberfest. So you can go either way, and so these individuals have identified themselves as Arab, call themselves Arab, teach their kids that they're Arab, and then that becomes who they are. It's an identity issue.
Look, we're coming down to our last few minutes. I'm just curious on your perspective on something else that we have talked about on and off with different guests on the show, and that is the fact that more and more the United States has relied on its military and military people to do what are essentially diplomatic missions. Things like peacekeeping, for example, or nation building, you know, for example. And there are some people who make the argument that that's because the military is not really trained to do that. The military primarily is trained to, you know, to blow stuff up. They're not necessarily trained, and that's not that they say that they can't, but, you know, they're trained for a different kind of mission. But then increasingly, you know, they're trained to fight. But increasingly, we are turning to them for a different kind of mission because we need people to do that. Do you think that there is some, you know, how do you think about that? And do you think that there is some kind of fundamental incompatibility between a force that's primarily trained to fight but is then asked to do things like peacekeeping?
Well, I think that, you know, from sometimes within the military, people say, well, you know, we are a fighting force. We're not a peacekeeping force. That's not what we do. We fight. We win wars. That's what we do. Where, you know, my opinion, you know, just me speaking, is that I think that we should be able to do both. I think that maybe there should be specialized units that do peacekeeping or people that are trained in that. I think that it's becoming more and more apparent that we are going to be continuing to do that more and more often around the world. And I think the majority of the forces, at least the individuals that I talk to, feel that a peacekeeping mission or a mission where, you know, they're escorting aid or they're handing out aid, you know, things like that, they're so worthwhile. And these military forces, the individuals that are in our forces, would volunteer in a second to go help out anybody. I mean, that's the main reason these people joined our military. It's because they wanted to help somebody who couldn't help themselves. They wanted to travel the world. They wanted to help people out. And so I definitely believe that we should, you know, take into consideration some modified training in order to do this, to go out there and to help build schools, you know, using our construction battalions, to go out there and build roads and build airports. And we do this stuff all over the world, but I think we should, you know, do it more often. I think that the majority of people in the world do respect the United States, and they really want us to help them in any way that we can.
And is there a problem with people seeing, because if you, not just you specifically, but the person comes wearing the uniform of the U.S. military, possibly at least for their own defense, carrying a sidearm, do you think that there's the danger that people are going to be suspicious and are going to think to themselves, well, what are these people really here for? What do they really want? What's their real purpose?
I think there are cynics around the world that will think that, but I think the majority of the time the people on the ground really, really respect us. I mean, there was a gentleman that we highlight in our movie. We spent a number of days with him in our camp, and he praises America for our help. He tells America, thank you so much for everything you've done. You know, we get our sacks of food, we get our oil, we get our tents, we get everything from America, and thank you, thank you, thank you. I mean, we asked everybody. We did, I don't even know how many interviews, hundreds. And we put the camera right on them and asked them the last question. Talk to the American people and tell them what you want. What do you want from the American people? What do you want to tell them? 99% of the time they said, thank you. First thing, thank you for everything you've done already. Thank you so much for everything you've given us. Thank you. And then a few of them were like, can you please do more? Can you please tell our story? Make sure you go spread our story. But every single one of them said thank you to America for helping them out. And in my opinion and what I've seen from working around the world in the 40-some countries I've been in, that's the general opinion from these individuals. There are some loud cynics out there that speak very loudly. Some of them speak with airplanes in the buildings. But the majority of people really respect the United States.
So what I'm just curious now, as we finish up, we have about a minute or so, I'm curious about what you see for yourself for your future. For the moment, at least, it sounds like you're going to continue to concentrate on trying to get out this story, talk about your experiences, talk about the book and the film that you've been involved in. Mm-hmm. After that, what?
Well, I think I'm going to continue on this type of work. There's a lot of other places that we can go. I'm working right now with a few individuals, with a small team of people trying to figure out ways that we can, you know, help the conflict directly on the ground. How can we get aid to these individuals where the aid groups can't reach them, because there's a million people, you know, beyond the reach of humanitarian aid right now. And so we're working through some solutions and trying to find ways to get aid into these people. And so that's what we're doing for the next year or so at least, and, you know, continuing with the book and the movie. But we'll move on to the next place, and we're trying to keep helping people from around the world.
Well, if people are interested in reading about the experiences of our guest, you can look for this book that we mentioned a couple of times. The book is The Devil Came on Horseback, Bearing Witness to the Genocide in Darfur, by our guest Brian Steidel, along with his sister, Gretchen Steidel Wallace. The book is published by Public Affairs. He's also been involved with the making of a documentary that has the same title, The Devil Came on Horseback. It has been shown at some festivals and will be available, I believe, in the fall on a DVD if you want to see it. Brian, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.